Wilde is working with Joyce. He is a cheerful, willing soul. Nothing ever worries or upsets him, and he is ever singing or making some joke or performing some amusing prank. Richards has taken over the keeping of the meteorological log. He is a young Australian, a hard, conscientious worker, and I look forward to good results from his endeavours. Jack, another young Australian, is his assistant. Hayward is the handyman, being responsible for the supply of blubber. Gaze, another Australian, is working in conjunction with Hayward. Spencer Smith, the padre, is in charge of photography and, of course, assists in the general routine work. Cope is the medical officer. The routine here is as follows. Four of us, myself, Stevens, Richards, and Spencer Smith, have breakfast at 7 a.m. The others are called at 9 a.m. and their breakfast is served. Then the table is cleared, the floor is swept, and the ordinary work of the day is commenced. At 1 p.m. we have what we call a counter lunch, that is, cold food and cocoa. We work from 2 p.m. till 5 p.m. After 5 p.m. people can do what they like. Dinner is at 7. The men play games, read, write up diaries. We turn in early since we have to economize fuel and light. Night watches are kept by the scientific men who have the privilege of turning in during the day. The day after my arrival here, I gave an outline of our situation and explained the necessity for economy in the use of fuel, light, and stores, in view of the possibility that we may have to stay here for 2 years. We are not going to commence work for the sledging operations until we know more definitely the fate of the Aurora. I dare not think any disaster has occurred. During the remaining days of June, the men washed and mended clothes, killed seals, made minor excursions in the neighbourhood of the hut, and discussed plans for the future. They had 6 dogs, 2 being bitches without experience of sledging. One of these bitches had given birth to a litter of pups, but she proved a poor mother and the young ones died. The animals had plenty of seal meat and were tended carefully. McIntosh called a meeting of all hands on June 26th for the discussion of the plans he had made for the depot-laying expedition to be undertaken during the following spring and summer. I gave an outline of the position and invited discussion from the members. Several points were brought up. I had suggested that one of our party should remain behind for the purpose of keeping the meteorological records and laying in a supply of meat and blubber. This man would be able to hand my instructions to the ship and pilot a party to the bluff. It had been arranged that Richards should do this. Several objected on the ground that the whole complement would be necessary, and after the matter had been put to the vote, it was agreed that we should delay the decision until the parties had some practical work and we had seen how they fared. The shortage of clothing was discussed, and Joyce and Wilde have agreed to do their best in this matter. October sledging on the barrier was mentioned as being too early, but is to be given a trial. These were the most important points brought up, and it was mutually and unanimously agreed that we could do no more. I know we are doing our best. The party was anxious to visit Cape Royds, north of Cape Evans, but at the end of June, open water remained right across the sound, and a crossing was impossible. At Cape Royds is the hut used by the Shackleton expedition of 1907-1909, and the stores and supplies it contains might have proved very useful. Joyce and Wilde make finneskoye, fur boots, from spare sleeping bags. McIntosh mentions that the necessity of economizing clothing and footgear prevented the men taking as much exercise as they would otherwise have done. A fair supply of canvas and leather had been found in the hut, and some men tried their hands at making shoes. Many seals had been killed and brought in, and the supply of meat and blubber was ample for present needs. During July, McIntosh made several trips northwards on the sea ice, but found always that he could not get far. A crack stretched roughly from Inaccessible Island to the Barne Glacier, and the ice beyond looked weak and loose. The improving light told of the returning sun. Richards and Jack were weighing out stores in readiness for the sledging expeditions. McIntosh, from the hill behind the hut, saw open water stretching westward from Inaccessible Island on August 1st, and noted that probably McMurdo Sound was never completely frozen over. A week later, the extent of the open water appeared to have increased, and the men began to despair of getting to Cape Royds. Blizzards were frequent and persistent. A few useful articles were found in the neighbourhood of the hut as the light improved, including some discarded socks and underwear left by members of the Scott expedition, and a case of candied peel, which was used for cakes. a small fire broke out in the hut on August 12th. The acetylene gas lighting plant installed in the hut by Captain Scott had been rigged, and one day it developed a leak. A member of the party searched for the leak with a lighted candle, and the explosion that resulted fired some woodwork. Fortunately, the outbreak was extinguished quickly. The loss of the hut at this stage would have been a tragic incident. McIntosh and Stevens paid a visit to Cape Royds on August 13th. They had decided to attempt the journey over the Barne Glacier, and after crossing a crevassed area, they got to the slopes of Cape Barne and thence down to the sea ice. They found this ice to be newly formed, but sufficiently strong for their purpose, and soon reached the Cape Royds hut. "The outer door of the hut we found to be off," wrote McIntosh. "A little snow had drifted into the porch, but with a shovel which we found outside, this was soon cleared away. We then entered, and in the centre of the hut found a pile of snow and ice, which had come through the open ventilator in the roof of the hut. We soon closed this. Stevens prepared a meal while I cleared the ice and snow away from the middle of the hut. After our meal, we commenced taking an inventory of the stores inside. Tobacco was our first thought. Of this we found one tin of Navy Cut and a box of cigars. Soap, too, which now ensures us a wash and clean clothes when we get back. We then began to look round for a sleeping bag. No bags were here, however, but on the improvised beds of the cases we found two mattresses, an old canvas screen, and two blankets. We took it in turns to turn in. Stevens started first, while I kept the fire going. No coal or blubber was here, so we had to use wood, which, while keeping the person alongside it warm, did not raise the temperature of the hut over freezing point. Over the stove, in a conspicuous place, we found a notice left by Scott's party that parties using the hut should leave the dishes clean. McIntosh and Stevens stayed at the Cape Royds hut over the next day and made a thorough examination of the stores there. They found, outside the hut, a pile of cases containing meats, flour, dried vegetables and sundries, at least a year's supply for a party of six. They found no new clothing, but made a collection of worn garments, which could be mended and made serviceable. Carrying loads of their spoils, they set out for Cape Evans on the morning of August 15th, across the sea ice. Very weak ice barred the way, and they had to travel round the coast. They got back to Cape Evans in 2 hours. During their absence, Wild and Gaze had climbed Inaccessible Island, Gaze having an ear badly frostbitten on the journey. The tobacco was divided among the members of the party. A blizzard was raging the next day, and McIntosh congratulated himself on having chosen the time for his trip fortunately. The record of the remaining part of August is not eventful. All hands were making preparations for the sledging and were rejoicing in the increasing daylight. The party tried the special sledging ration prepared under my own direction, and all agreed it was excellent, both in bulk and taste. 3 emperor penguins, the first seen since the landing, were caught on August 19th. By that time, the returning sun was touching with gold the peaks of the western mountains and throwing into bold relief the massive form of Erebus. The volcano was emitting a great deal of smoke, and the glow of its internal fires showed occasionally against the smoke clouds above the crater. Stevens, Spencer Smith, and Cope went to Cape Royds on the 20th, and were still there when the sun made its first appearance over Erebus on the 26th. Preceding days had been cloudy, and the sun, although above the horizon, had not been visible. "The morning broke clear and fine," wrote McIntosh. "Over Erebus, the sun's rays peeped through the massed cumulus and produced the most gorgeous cloud effects. The light made us all blink and at the same time caused the greatest exuberance of spirits. We felt like men released from prison. I stood outside the hut and looked at the truly wonderful scenery all round. The West Mountains were superb in their wild grandeur. The whole outline of peaks some 80 or 90 miles distant showed up, stenciled in delicate contrast to the skyline. The immense ice slopes shone white as alabaster against dark shadows. The sky to the west over the mountains was clear, except for low-lying banks at the foot of the slopes round about Mount Discovery. To the south, hard streaks of stratus lay heaped up to 30 degrees above the horizon. Then Erebus commenced to emit volumes of smoke, which rose hundreds of feet and trailed away in a northwesterly direction. The southern slopes of Erebus were enveloped in a mass of cloud. The party from Cape Royds returned that afternoon, and there was disappointment at their report that no more tobacco had been found. The sledging of stores to Hut Point in preparation for the depot-laying journeys on the barrier was to begin on September 1st.